Good morning again. If you have a Bible with you, you can open again to the book of Exodus, chapter 6 this morning. Exodus chapter 6, verse 14, and then we'll go through chapter 7, verse 13. We're going to cover quite a bit of ground this morning, and if you're not a person who reads ahead, you'll soon figure out why we're going to cover a lot of ground this morning. And today, the title of the message is Proof, and I think that as we go through this, hopefully we see this passage that we're going to look at this morning begins with a genealogy. And I know that all of you, when you do your own home Bible study and reading, when you get to the genealogies, you say, yes, I get to read 74 names I cannot pronounce. So we'll talk about that. This genealogy gives some proof as to who Moses and Aaron are and where they have come from, and some credibility in that. But we're also going to see Moses and Aaron go before Pharaoh and give some proof about who God is and about their calling and their being sent by God. And we'll see some proof also of some prophecy that has been given to them in that moment will come true. So I was thinking this week, a month or so ago, we were in the book of Exodus and we came to what at least I considered to be a particularly difficult text and hard to talk about. And I said that, you know, we're a church that we preach verse by verse, and we don't skip any and all of those things. And then I get to this Sunday, and I think, I don't know if that was a great idea, right? So we're going to try to read this genealogy the best that we can. Some of you probably will be able to pronounce some of these names better than I can. Forgive me for that. But we're going to try the best that we can and see what we can learn from it. So follow with me, if you will, in Exodus chapter 6. Begin reading in verse 14. And again, we'll read through chapter 7, verse 13. God's perfect and inspired word says this: these are the heads of their fathers' houses, the sons of Reuben. The firstborn of Israel were Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. These are the families of Reuben. And the sons of Simeon are Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shul, the son of the Canaanite woman. These are the families of Simeon. These are the names of the sons of Levi according to their generations: Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. And the years of the life of Levi were 137. The sons of Gershon were Libni and Shimei, according to their families. And the sons of Kohath were Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uzziel. And the years of the life of Kohath were 133. The sons of Merari were Mahil and Mushai. These are the families of Levi, according to their generations. Now Amram took for himself Jochebed, his father's sister, as wife, and she bore him Aaron and Moses. And the years of the life of Amram were 137. The sons of Izhar were Korah, Napheg, and Zichri. The sons of Uzziel were Mishael, Elzaphan, and Zithri. Aaron took for himself Elisheba, daughter of Aminadab, sister of Nashon, his wife, and she bore him Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. And the sons of Korah were Asar, Elkanah, Abiasaph. These are the families of the Korahites. Eleazar, Aaron's son, took for himself one of the daughters of Putiel, his wife, and she bore him Phinehas. These are the heads of the fathers' houses of Levites, according to their families. These are the same, Aaron and Moses, to whom the Lord said, "Bring out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their armies." These are the ones who spoke to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to bring out the children of Israel from Egypt. These are the same, Moses and Aaron. And it came to pass on the day the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt that the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "I am the Lord, speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you." But Moses said to the Lord, "Behold, I am of uncircumcised lips. How shall Pharaoh heed me?" So the Lord said to Moses, "See that I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you. And Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, and I will stretch out my hand of Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them." Then Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded them, so they did. And Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 years old, when they spoke to Pharaoh. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "When Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, 'Show a miracle for yourselves,' then you shall say to Aaron, 'Take your rod and cast it before Pharaoh, and let it become a serpent.'" So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh, and they did so, just as the Lord commanded. And Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. But Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers, so the magicians of Egypt. They also did in like manner with their enchantments. For every man threw down his rod, and they became serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. And Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, as the Lord had said. So the question, I think, for us this morning is, the story in Exodus, as recorded by Moses, is moving along. And last week, we see God command Moses and Aaron to go back and talk to Pharaoh again. And everything is kind of clicking along and moving along. And when you get down to verse 13 in chapter 6, what you think you're going to find is what you find at the beginning of chapter 7, or even in the middle of chapter 7. And so the question is, why is this genealogy there? And we need to understand something about the way that this is written. And there may be a little bit of dispute about this, but I think the overwhelming understanding is this. Remember that Moses is writing this, and he's writing this later. So he's writing an account about what happened in the Exodus for the people that will come after them so that they don't forget. So he's recording this after the fact. So this isn't necessarily real time, okay? This isn't happening in the moment. This is all happening, and then he is recording it afterward. So for some reason, through the inspiration of God, at this very moment, Moses feels inclined by the Spirit to write down this genealogy. Now, again, why at this moment and why at this time? We're not 100% sure. I would say probably because what everything in Exodus is pointing to is getting ready to happen. The whole point of Moses telling the story of the Israelites in Egypt is for them to what? Leave Egypt. And they're getting ready to do that, and God is getting ready to display his power, and he's getting ready to display his power through Moses and Aaron. And I think Moses wants to stop at this moment and say, I just want you to make sure that you understand, one, who we are, and two, where this power comes from. This is not a story about Moses and Aaron. This is not a story about Israelites. This is a story about the redemptive, rescuing power of God for people who are helpless. And that's what I think Moses is wanting to say. Listen, this is not about us. This is about God. This is about what God is doing for us. If you notice at the end of that, in verse 26, these are the same, Aaron and Moses, whom the Lord said, bring out of the children of Israel from the land of Egypt according to their armies. These are the ones who spoke to Pharaoh of Egypt to bring out the children of Israel from Egypt. These are the same Moses and Aaron. So again, I think Moses is trying to say that these are the ones that God has chosen. These are the ones that God has blessed. And these are the reasons with which God has chosen them. There's a lot of aspects of this genealogy that we could go down. And if you want to go down those on your own time, you are welcome to do that. But I think that there's a few things this morning that are important that we need to talk about. So the first thing is that he's showing proof to the descendants, to those who have come after in this moment. He's showing proof that they, Moses and Aaron, first and foremost, are Israelites. That they are in the line and the lineage of Israel. That they ultimately are in the lineage of Abraham. That they really are Hebrew people. If you notice in verses 14 through 16, he starts naming off these people. In verse 14, he says, the heads of the fathers' houses. In verse 14, he says, the son of Reuben. In verse 15, he says, the sons of Simeon. And then in verse 16, he says, the sons of Levi. Reuben, Simeon, and Levi are all Jacob's sons. Jacob, who is Israel. So these men are Israelites. And again, these aren't all of Jacob's sons. Most of you know the story and the family of Jacob and Israel. These aren't all of them, but he's giving this genealogy just to get to the point that he needs to, right? So he goes oldest, next oldest, third oldest. Levi's the one he needs to get to because that's the lineage of Moses and Aaron. So he just stops there. It's not like Moses doesn't know the rest of the family. He just talks about what he needs to talk about. So you can see that in other places in the Bible if you'd like. So what we see is that they are Israelites. So why does that matter? Remember the life of Moses. Moses lived as an Israelite for a short amount of time for the first 80 years of his life. So what Moses is doing is there could have been talk and rumors like, well, I thought that Moses was an Egyptian. Somebody told me that Moses grew up in Pharaoh's house. Isn't Moses an Egyptian? Or somebody said, well, I thought the person who came and delivered us out of Egypt, I thought he came from Midian. I thought he was a Midianite. No, Moses is saying very clearly that he is an Israelite, that through this lineage and through this line, God saves people. That's important for us because it's through the same lineage and line that God saved us through his son, Jesus Christ. So what we see is that he is not an Egyptian. He is not a Midianite. Rather, he is the son of Jacob, who also is under Abraham. He goes all the way back to Abraham. If you look up in chapter 6, verse 3, it says, I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Over and over, this is something that's used in the Bible, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And what he's saying is after Jacob was Levi, and then eventually here comes Moses and Aaron. So what we see is that first and foremost, he's an Israelite. But secondly, if you look in verse 20, it says in verse 20, now Amram took for himself Jochebed, his father's sister, as wife, and she bore him Aaron and Moses, and the years of the life of Amram were 137. We're not going to spend all morning on that, but just a couple of quick things about this. When it says in verse 20 that he took his father's sister as a wife, that's what he did. And first, he's not breaking a law because the law hasn't been given yet. So he hasn't broken a law. It would have been later. It was not commonplace after that in the Jewish community to do that. It's certainly not commonplace to do that today. And the other thing you need to think about is, remember, these people are living to be 137, 140 years old. They're having children throughout a lot longer of that lifespan than what we would ever do. So they're probably the same age. It's not something weird like that. But anyway, here's why that matters. What he is saying is that Moses and Aaron in particular, are Levites. And they are from the line and the tribe of Levi. And here's why this matters. The Levites would then become the priests, and they would be the ones to walk through the law and keep the law and teach the law and all that stuff. And what it's saying here, whenever Amram marries that person who's in his family, what he's saying is they are 100% Levites. They got a double dose. So what he's saying is that they are Levites and that they have the authority to act in Levitical ways. Moses had the authority to give sacrifices even before the law came. Aaron and his children had the rights and the authority to do that. So he's showing first that they're Israelites, but not only that, but they are Levites. And then again in verses 26 and 27, he says, these are the same ones. I want you to know who they are. I want you to see that God had a plan from the very beginning, that even at Abraham, all the way through to Moses, God had a plan of redemption, that he was choosing out people and he was making sure that people came so that they could be delivered. So he wants them to see who they are. This is God's plan. This is God's providence. Moses and Aaron did not end up in that moment by happenstance. They were there in that time because of God's providence, because of his sovereignty, because his perfect plan that he is executing for the sake of the people and for his glory. The last thing that I want to point out in this genealogy, or about this genealogy before we move on this morning, is one, it's important for us to know where Moses and Aaron came from. And it was important for those people to know where Moses and Aaron came from. But I just want to remind you that in the New Testament, a lot of times when we think about genealogies, we think about the Old Testament, don't we? And we think about two pages worth of this person begot this person and they begot this person and over and over and over again. But we also recognize that in the Gospels, there are genealogies. Jesus has two genealogies in the Gospels. In Matthew and Luke, both record a genealogy of Jesus, and both of those prove things about who Jesus is. They prove that he has a kingly line through the line of King David. They prove that he has a priestly line. They prove that he is truly man, that he was born of Mary, and that he truly was man so that he could die for you and I who are men. But there's another genealogy in the New Testament. That's in the Gospel of John. It doesn't look like anything else, but there's a spiritual, heavenly genealogy of Jesus in the Gospel of John. And it teaches us that he truly was God and that he is the Son of Almighty God, showing us that Jesus is truly man and truly God, the only one who can really save us. So it was important for them to know who Moses and Aaron was. It's even more important for us to know who Jesus is. And he is the Son of God, that he became a man, that he took on flesh so that he could die, paying for the sin in your flesh, in my flesh, so that we can turn to him and be saved and live with him in eternity and worship him as God. So we see first proof about who Moses and Aaron are. And then in verse 28 in chapter 6 through verse 7, in chapter 7 it says this, So this is just a continuation of what happened before. It says, and it came to pass on the day that the Lord spoke to Moses in the land of Egypt, that the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I am the Lord, speak to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, all that I say to you. But Moses said before the Lord, behold, I am of uncircumcised lips, and how shall Pharaoh heed me? So the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet. You shall speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother shall tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies of my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And I will stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. Then Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded them. And Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron was 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. So the second thing that we see is that, again, Moses is just continuing this process of talking about what's happened. You could go back into chapter 6 and you'll see almost all of these things already said. So we're not going to spend a huge amount of time on that this morning, but I just want to remind you that God gives them a command. He again instructs Moses and Aaron to go and to speak to Pharaoh, to go and to say the words that he has told them to say. He's given them a command. It's the same command in chapter 6, verse 13. It says, then the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, and gave them a command for the children of Israel and the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, to bring the children out of the land of Egypt. First, he gives them a command. And then, just like we've seen already, again, this is a continuation, there's an excuse. And Moses says, well, I can't do it. I have uncircumcised lips. I don't speak the way that I should speak. My speaking isn't as good as it should be. And it's the same excuse as chapter 6, verse 12. And Moses spoke before the Lord, the children of Israel have not heeded me. How then shall Pharaoh heed me, for I am uncircumcised lips? Again, he's just repeating where he was at before. There's also a prophecy in verses 3 through 6 where he says that they're going to speak and then Pharaoh is not going to believe them. And again, he's already told them that over and over again, that you're going to speak and Pharaoh's not going to believe you and he's going to harden his heart. But I do want to bring one thing out of these verses that I want to make sure that we see. Look in verse 5 of chapter 7. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And I will stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. So God is saying in this prophecy that Pharaoh is not going to heed. He's not going to listen. And in fact, God says that he's going to harden his heart, or he's going to allow his heart to get harder. He's going to give Pharaoh exactly what he wants. And he's going to let his heart get harder and harder and harder. And we've talked about this question of why wouldn't God soften Pharaoh's heart? Wouldn't it have been easier if God would have softened his heart and he would have had compassion on the Israelites, and he would have just let the Israelites go? And we talked about the fact that God wants to be seen and glorified, and that he wants to be able to not only free the people, but that he is a just God, and he's going to punish the Egyptians for their cruelty and their murder of the Israelite people. But here's the most important thing, that he wants them to know who he is. He wants to give proof of his power, proof of his character, proof of his lordship, proof that he is God above all of their gods. Remember a few weeks ago, I told you that this is going to be a battle of the gods, big G God, our God, Jehovah God, versus all of the little g gods of Egypt. And what God is saying is, I want the Egyptians to know that I am the Lord. I want them to see me as powerful. I want to crush and defeat all little g gods. And in fact, in chapter 6, verse 7, it says, I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of Egypt. He wants proof not just for the Egyptians, but he wants proof for the Israelites. I want the Israelites first to know that I am their God, and I want Egyptians to know that I am God. He wants to glorify himself amongst the people. He's not seeking to glorify Moses and Aaron. He's seeking to glorify himself amongst the people. I want them to know me so that they will trust me, so that they will follow me, so that they will worship me. I want them to know me and fear me. So now, finally, chapter 7, verse 8, we get all the way back to where we thought we were going before all of this genealogy happened. Moses and Aaron go back and talk to Pharaoh. But Pharaoh's going to need some proof as well. And God knows that Pharaoh is going to need some proof. And so he has already equipped Moses and Aaron. He's already shown them their ability to do this thing. So he tells them even before they go in, this is going to happen. He's going to need proof. And when he needs proof, this is how you give it to him. So look with me in verses 8 through 13. It says, then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, show a miracle for yourselves, then you shall say to Aaron, take your rod and cast it before Pharaoh and let it become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh, and they did so, just as the Lord commanded. And Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. But Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers, so the magicians of Egypt, they also did in like manner with their enchantments. For every man threw down his rod and became serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. And Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, as the Lord had said. So now they're getting ready to go in, and God says, when Pharaoh asks you for a sign, when he asks you for a miracle, this is what you should do. So first off, the reason I think that Moses and Aaron needed to do this before Pharaoh, one, was to show off the power of God and the ability of God and his control over creation. But just in order to get into the door, they needed some sort of credibility. Two men don't just come walking into Pharaoh's house and say, hey, we've got a message from God. And Pharaoh says, oh, well, by all means, I'm not doing anything. Come on in, as he's ruling the majority of the world. When they come in and they say, I have a message from the God of the Hebrews, what he says is, well, then I'm going to need to see something that proves that you are from the God of the Hebrews. He has all of these sorcerers and all these magicians who are doing things that are trying to prove these false gods. And he says, if you have a God that I don't know, which he's already said, you're going to have to prove that to me. So God prepares him and he says, have Aaron throw down the rod and it will become a serpent. So what we see is that they have to gain this credibility, and he turns this rod into a serpent. Now, I just want to stop for just a moment and just put this out there, okay? You can do with it what you will. But the Hebrew word there is tannin when it says serpent. And we know that God, through his power, has already turned probably that very rod into a serpent before. Remember that? And he's already turned it into a serpent. But here's what's interesting. The word used chapters before for serpent is not the same word that is used here. And this word used here, tannin, can be used to describe a serpent. But in the Bible, in the Old Testament, this word is used to describe many other things. And in the Hebrew language, it's used to describe all sorts of things. Basically, any scary creature that comes out of the water. So anything in that area that could be in the water, out of the water, that scares you, they could describe it as this word, tannin. There are many people who believe that this wasn't a serpent, that this was actually a crocodile. And I don't know if it was. It probably wasn't. But here's what I would submit to you, that God is proving, again, his power and authority and dominion over creation. And he is showing that the things that the Egyptians would be fearful of or hold in high regard and worship the way they did, that those things are nothing to our God, that he can create them and eliminate them in a snap. So they prove the power of God. They prove the authority of God by throwing down the rod. And then Pharaoh says, that's no big deal. And he calls out all of the sorcerers and all of the magicians and all of the people, and now everybody's throwing a rod down, and there's snakes or crocodiles or leviathans or whatever it is all over the place. The whole palace is full of these animals, right? And it's this craziness. And their sorcerers do that. And here's the thing, when we read that, we think, well, wait a minute, how can they do that? I thought that was all fake. I thought that wasn't real. How did they have the power of that? I thought that was only God's power. Here, I want to submit a couple of things to you because this applies to today. So it matters that we talk about these things. First, in verses 11 and 12, in verse 11, it says, they did in like manner with their enchantments. That word enchantments gives the imagery of smoke and fire. So that they did these things, not just with that, but that there was smoke and fire and there was a production that happened. And so some people would believe that they didn't really change into, but that there was some sort of smoke and mirrors, if you will. There was some sort of illusion. You know, they were holding snakes and chucking snakes and hiding rods. There's people who would believe that. That's probably not the case. But sometimes there's smoke and mirrors that are attributed to the power of God or the power of another God, and they're not real. They didn't really happen. And they're just made to look like they happen, sound like they happen, and they're meant to convince and confuse people of something else. But here's what we need to understand, and here's what I believe about what happened here. I believe that those rods really did turn into snakes because it was done through demonic and satanic power. And these people were worshiping the enemy. They were under the influence of the enemy of God. And through his power, these things happened. But whether it was smoke and mirrors or whether it was the real thing, here's what we need to understand and here's what we need to keep our focus on, is that no matter how those other serpents came into being, they were merely a cheap, weak imitation of God. They don't have the same authority or the same power, and they're not from Him. And we know that. We know that because if we look in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 8 and 9, in 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 8 and 9, it says, "Now Jannes and Jambres resisted Moses. So do these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds disapprove concerning the faith. But they will progress no further, for their folly will be manifest to all, as theirs also was." All the way back, Paul is talking. These are the men. Those are two of the guys that were standing there that threw their rods down and said that they tried to suppress the truth with something that wasn't really as powerful. It was less. And here's the thing, church. Here's where we have to be careful in our culture today. And I know that I say this kind of stuff all the time, and it's just everywhere you look, there are people who would suppress the truth today with things that look like and sound like and feel like things of God. But here's what they are. And there would be some people who this will greatly offend. They are either smoke and mirrors or they are demonic. There was a church in Joplin not long ago that had an absolute false prophet come in, and he was proclaiming to have done all sorts of healings and leg lengthenings and all sorts of stuff. Listen, either it didn't happen or it was of the devil. It wasn't of God. There are no healers today. Does God heal people? Absolutely He does. Absolutely He does, but He does not do it in that way anymore. This Bible is sufficient. And He says that Jannes and Jambres was trying to submit to suppress the truth. They were trying to suppress the truth of who God was, and today they'll use the same tactics to suppress the truth in the real gospel. Because they don't want to tell you about sin, because they don't want to tell you about repentance, because they don't want to tell you about giving, because they don't want to tell you about that stuff, and so they're going to try to draw you in with something else. Don't fall for it. Don't fall for the smoke and mirrors, and don't get sucked into things that are demonic. And I'm not trying to be over the top, but it's everywhere. It is everywhere. It's in churches in our county. It's everywhere, and we must look for it. Here, we'll end on a better note. This is the end of the sermon. Are you ready? Moses and Aaron walk in, and it looks like they're trying to prove that God is all-powerful and in control, and it looks like they've been disproved, because here comes all the magicians and the sorcerers, and all the snakes or the crocodiles are all over the floor, and it looks like they're just like everybody else. It looks like their God is just one of many gods. It looks like He's not as powerful as they think they are. And then I want you to see what happens. Look in verses 12 and 13. "For every man threw down his rod, and they became serpents." Listen to this, But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. But Aaron's rod swallowed up theirs. Because God is proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that these are false imitations, and the truth stands for truth, and He is all powerful, and He is almighty, and He is in control, and they are cheap imitations. And the truth doesn't change. And He proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that their God is the God, and the rest are little g false gods. But what happens? In verse 13, Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them as the Lord had said. His heart grew hard. Isn't it amazing that even in the world today, that same thing can happen? What we see to be clearly the grace and the goodness and the power and the glory of God can harden the heart of those who choose to not believe. But even this, church, even this proves that our God is in control. Even the hardness of the heart of Pharaoh proves that our God is always right. Why? Look at the end of verse 13. "As the Lord had said." He didn't do anything that the Lord hadn't already said would happen. Nothing happened there that the Lord was not already in control of. So friends, this morning, my encouragement to you would be to seek after the Jesus of the Bible, to seek after the true prophet, priest, and king, to know who He is, to not be distracted by the things of the world, to trust in the truth of the Word of God and not be distracted by things of the enemy and cheap imitations, and to believe that our God is the only true God and trust in Him accordingly. Do not fear the imitations of the world, but trust in Him and Him alone.